And there's this fantastic Buddha who lives out in the Western Pure Land. And as the Mahayana developed, the history of Chinese, you know, Mahayana Buddhism, they developed a quite an elaborate cosmology. It was very different from that of early Buddhism. And they had this idea in the Western, you know, off in the Western cosmos somewhere, there is a Buddha called Amida Buddha. And that Amida Buddha, through the power of his own practice and the power of his spiritual power, has the ability of saving us, of helping us getting reborn in his paradise, his pure land, if we have a sincere heart and sincerely kind of surrender or sincerely kind of express our sincere faith in him. And so it sounds very much like certain kind of Protestant religion where it's salvation through grace and not through works. And it turns out, so many of us, you know, I don't know how you think about religion like that. Some of you might find it very appealing and some of you might find it a little bit challenging, the very idea that Buddhists would have these kinds of ideas. You're getting away from that. And however, one of the beautiful aspects of this is that in the history of Japanese Buddhism, there was a period of time, several centuries, where some of the most spiritually realized people were the people coming out of the Japanese Pure Land tradition. There was something very powerful that happens when the kind of surrender to an other power that that can be very transformative to a human being. And it also has the benefit of the people tended to be very humble also. And they tended to be these people who were Pure Land saints, in a sense, tended to be very ordinary people like, you know, farmers and fishermen. And they weren't the great, lofty kind of scholar monks who practiced in Japan. And another interesting thing about this, other power approach, some of you probably are familiar with the writings of D.T. Suzuki. He's been, he was a Japanese Zen scholar who wrote a lot of books about Zen, got translated into English. Some, I think maybe might have written them in English, some of them. And he's been attributed to having introduced Zen to the West. To some great degree, he was the one who really introduced Zen to the West. His books really inspired a generation of people. What's not known is that in Japanese, while he's writing these books and publishing them in English for Americans about Zen, all about self-power, self, you know, he was writing about Pure Land Buddhism for the Japanese. And at the end of his life, he thought, maybe I made a mistake in introducing Zen to the West. Maybe I should have been this Pure Land Buddhism would have been more to the point or more useful or something. Something like that, he said. So here you have this very famous Zen scholar who in the West he's kind of revered as being pointing to this immediacy of Zen practice, cutting through Zen, and he inspired all these artists and writers from the 50s. And some of them, remember, there was one artist type in the 50s who apparently was on stage with all these people in New York City, and he was going to demonstrate or give a talk about his art, and he pointed to the wall, and you know, it was a blue wall, you know, and he says, you know, "What do you see there?" And you see that. And people started giving answers. You know, they see the sky, they saw the ocean. I don't know what the people said. And finally said, "It's just blue." You know, it's a kind of Zen idea. Just, you know, just immediate kind of connection to reality as it actually is. And you don't try to, you cut through all the concepts, ideas. And in Zen, you really rely on your own power, your own ability to engage in the practice. You don't so much rely on some other deity, other being, other power so much, at least, but rather you really engage yourself, concentrate, engage yourself in this practice. In this dichotomy between self-power and other power, probably Theravadan Buddhism, the Buddhism of our kind of Vipassana tradition, would seemingly fall very much so in this self-power camp. And in fact, some of the writings, some of the discourses of the Buddha, like the Dhammapada, can be seen as one of the great pieces of world religion, pieces of religious literature in human history, championing self-reliant spirituality. It's up to us. No one else can do it for us. We have to engage in it. It's all about, you know, self-cultivation, developing ourselves, and finding our own freedom. And so it seemingly falls very much on the spirituality of the Buddha in the self-power camp and not relying on anything else. So you have this great divide, and you find that same divide in Christianity. And the same, a lot of the same ideas, and I think in Protestantism, if you try yourself to cultivate the spiritual life, it's a kind of arrogance, a kind of conceit, pride. When you have these huge tensions or huge dichotomies in religious systems, it's probably best not to come down and decide one side is right and the other side is wrong, but rather to see maybe there's something something that are pointing to that divide that points to some way in which they're both true, that other power and self-power are both true in some way. And I know that a lot of people are involved in AA, and AA puts a lot of emphasis on, do you want to use the word other power? Higher power, the higher power is the expression there. Some higher power. And it's been one of the phenomenal religious, spiritual movements in the United States in the last 100 years has been the whole movement of AA. Millions and millions of people have been deeply moved and changed by it. And people probably who couldn't have been helped in any other way. And there's great dramatic stories of people who were, you know, on the way to death, literally. And then they came to AA, and through the teachings of AA and the idea of kind of finding a higher power that they're going to kind of surrender to and rely on to save them. You know, the first step in AA is, it's helpless. I'm hopeless. You know, I can't do anything for myself. And the second step is something about, you know, I believe that a higher power is going to, what really is going to make the difference for me. And the third step is something like, you know, making the steps to kind of surrender to that higher power. Isn't that more or less the first three steps? No one's willing to say? Sure, certainly there's people here who've been to AA or know about it. And but anyway, no testimonials today, please. I'm Gil, and I'm a recovering Buddhist. So people in AA, people are also Buddhists, struggle a little bit. You know, what does higher power mean for Buddhists? Because usually it means God for people, and Buddhists don't use the idea of God. And so what is this higher power thing? So is there kind of a higher power? Is there an other power? And is there self-power that's part of Theravada Buddhism or part of Vipassana practice? And I'd like to suggest that there's both, and that understanding both is really important. Because if you only understand one and not the other, you probably shortchange the spiritual life. And some people fall on one side or the other a little bit too much, where they think it's all about me. And they might not think that explicitly so much, but the way they behave, that's the way it is. I have to fix it. It's up to me. I have to manipulate this. I have to fix this. I have to judge this. It's up to me judging it right. And so they come to meditation, for example, or spiritual practice, and it's kind of like sometimes like a boxing match, you know, against their mind or something. And they're struggling, they're trying, and they're measuring every possible kind of moment of practice. How successful am I? Have I gotten there yet? Am I doing it right? You know, because it's so much up to them and their efforts and whether they're doing it right or not. And they listen. Some people listen so carefully to the instructions of these poor teachers who try to teach what it's all about. And they try to, you know, they try to kind of hold on to every possible instructions as being the answer, and they struggle, and they hold on, they push, and they, you know, and then they just get a headache, you know, and then they blame the teachers for, you know, giving the wrong instructions, and they go to another teacher, and they hang on to those instructions, they try, you know, try to do this just right, and it's just up to them, you know, they're holding on, you know, trying to do it themselves. And then other people who don't think it's up to them at all, and kind of, I call it sometimes magical thinking. People think that if they just sit down to close their eyes in the meditation posture long enough, that something will happen and they'll get somehow saved or enlightened or something will be great. And so they just kind of, and I know people who've gotten angry after several years of doing this kind of approach, kind of, you know, nothing's happened yet. You know, all this great promise that Buddhism offered, you know, of enlightenment. I've been sitting and doing my duty. I've showed up for Dharma talks and I've, you know, and the Dharma talks, you know, maybe they haven't been profound enough, these Dharma talks. Maybe they need to be more profound, you know, it's because the Dharma talks are going to do it for, you know, that's what it's all about, is the, you know, Dharma talks, or maybe it's the sittings, you know. I've been on how many 3-month retreats, and, you know, nothing's happened. I think it was Ajahn Sumedho said, or Ajahn Chah said, if sitting long was what it took, chickens would be enlightened.
They are.
Have you watched chickens in the chicken yard and see how they behave? If that's enlightenment. So we need to have both. We need to have both, you know, self-engagement and a kind of trust or surrendering or relying on something other than self. And what is that other that we can rely on? One of the, in Theravadan Buddhism, that other that sometimes is likened, or some people who do interfaith dialogue will compare to God, the God of Buddhists, you know. This is a comparable idea in Buddhism. And is the Dharma. And the Dharma is defined as that which upholds, supports, leads onwards, that which provides safety, provides a refuge. The Dharma is that which is onward leading, leads onward, just like an escalator leads onward, right? The Dharma is something that is timeless, is something that is always here, always visible, always available right here and now. The Dharma is kind of that which is, people take refuge in Buddhism. They surrender to the Dharma. They depend on the Dharma. There's a beautiful expression that I don't have quite right, but it's something like those who trust the Dharma are protected by the Dharma. And I kind of feel that my life has been a manifestation of that. That every time in my life where I felt like I had to choose between the Dharma and, or the practice and some other reasonable thing to do with life, and I chose the Dharma, I feel the Dharma then supported me. Doors opened, support happened. It just seemed to work out quite beautifully for me every time. So those who trust the Dharma or those who protect the Dharma are protected by the Dharma in return. So it's a wonderful reciprocal relationship. Those who surrender to the Dharma are protected or supported by the Dharma. And so what is the Dharma? What is this thing that we can support, be supported by and find refuge in? And why is it that it's a reliable refuge for Buddhists? Why is it kind of a power that supports us? There are many different definitions of what Dharma, the word Dharma is. And it's all should be maybe seen as being kind of integrated together and kind of supporting each other. The most obvious or most easiest definition of it is that it is a the teachings of the Buddha. But the Dharma is much more than that. And the tradition says that if tradition gives two definitions of Dharma, the second definition of Dharma is that it is the penetration into those teachings, or the penetration into the reality of those teachings. If it gives three definitions of Dharma, it's the teachings of the Buddha, it's the penetration into the heart of the teachings of the Buddha, the reality the Buddha is pointing towards. And the third definition is it's the practice that leads to that. That's the Dharma. So the teachings, you know, something maybe you can read in the book, it seems a little bit apart from us, apart from a human being. But the penetration and the practice is something that you have to participate in order to be part of, in order to, you know, it's not out there. It's not a Dharma which is separate from yourself. A Dharma that only appears, only exists in the living of it, in the engagement in it. So and when we penetrate the Dharma, that's where the Dharma, that then the Dharma exists in that kind of way, when there's penetration or attainment or realization. Or when there's practice, the Dharma is right there in the practice itself. So we have to practice in order to have the Dharma to be there. We have to step onto the escalator in order for the escalator to carry us somewhere. So the Dharma is also meant is also defined as practice and as the realization that comes through the practice. So when Buddhists take refuge in Dharma and find support from the Dharma, they're finding support not passively from something external from themselves, but they're finding support from something that comes reciprocally when we engage, when we place ourselves into it, when we do something. When we go for refuge, the word is to walk. When we walk into something, all our whole being walks into the Dharma. When we walk into the Dharma then supports us in return. So there's kind of, you know, the two don't appear separately. I don't know if this is a good analogy, but if you know how to swim, and you put yourself into the water, into the ocean, then you have to put yourself into the ocean in order to then float. The water will support you, but only if you swim in the water, or tread water or something. So there's a reciprocal relationship. You don't float in the water unless you practice swimming, or treading the water, right, to doing something. You have to do something, and then the water supports you. But if you don't do anything, most people, unless they have a certain kind of different, you know, body fat relate ratio, whatever, will sink. Or if you're in the Dead Sea. And so you have to do something. But then in doing something, there's support that comes back. And what is that kind of support? Is it a kind of other power? It is a kind of an other power, or higher power if you wish, because if something happens in practicing which you can't attribute to your doing. But you have to do also. You can't just sit there and wait. So you have to engage. But once you engage, something happens. Are you responsible for floating in the water? Well, a little bit, aren't you? You have to do something, right? You have to take some credit. But don't take too much credit. Because, you know, the water is also supporting you, holding you up. So there is something that comes back from the Dharma when we engage in the practice. The practice returns something to us. So what is that? In a kind of most rational kind of way, one simple explanation would be that a lot of the ways in which we suffer in our lives is our activities. We tighten down, we resist, we hold on tight to something. There's stress, there's activities, there's thoughts and ideas we engage in and run around in. Ideas of self, ideas of other, ideas of what we need in life, ideas of what reality is, how we have to protect ourselves from reality. All kinds of ideas, all kinds of things we hold on to and cling to. And these are all activities of the mind. As we engage in practice, as we engage in mindfulness practice, for example, one of the things that happens is we begin to relax the activity of the mind. And when the activity of the mind relaxes, then all these ways that we cause ourselves suffering begin to relax also, all these activities. And then it gives space in the mind for something else to happen. And what is that other thing that can happen? And it seems that the psyche has a self-organizing principles. It tends to move towards health and healing. And so partly just getting out of our own way can create that healing. So the bandage analogy that I like to use, you could, I mean, don't do it please, but you could, you know, intentionally, you know, cut yourself with a knife, maybe unintentionally in the kitchen, and have a little cut. But you can't do much about healing that. You could do some superficial things. You can clean the wound, and you can put a bandage over it. But you can't, you know, point your finger at that wound. You heal, you know. And you could never in your mind orchestrate the tremendous amount of biochemical, physical things that have to happen to get your body to heal that cut. I mean, I think it's really complex medically what happens there. And it's too much. You have to rely, you have to do something. You have to keep the wound clean. But then something else, this is healing, the healing properties of the body take over and it heals the cut. So in the same way with our psyche, if we get out of the way, we have to do something. We have to learn to let go. We have to learn to surrender. We have to learn to be mindful and attentive. But then there seems to be a self-organizing principle in the psyche that tends to move us towards psychic health, move us towards more wholesome states of mind. And I think this is encapsulated in the Theravada tradition by the frequent reference that the idea that the absence of unhealthy qualities is not just the absence of them, but is the presence of health. So the absence of greed is not just the absence of greed, but implies in the tradition the presence of generosity. The absence of hate is not just simply the, you know, emptiness and absence of hate, but implies the presence of love. And the absence of delusion implies the presence of wisdom. as we get greed, hate, and delusion out of the way, something seems to come forth in that space that is, healthy or wholesome or healing or something. So the other power in that sense could just be some other power that's in ourselves. It doesn't have to be attributed to something outside of ourselves. I think it was maybe the great Max Faraday, who discovered all these great laws of thermodynamics. And someone asked him once where they came from, those great discoveries. And he said, something, to paraphrase, I don't have it right anymore, but something within me, outside of myself, discovered them. He wasn't going to take credit for those discoveries in the kind of normal way, place where we usually think who we are. The normal sense of self, idea of self, who we are, that, the way we think about ourselves, the way we engage, that's not where they came from. So like sometimes in dreams, sometimes we wake up and some idea comes to us. Oh, where'd that come from? I was sitting in meditation once when I was back at Zen Center. I worked at the Tassajara Bakery. And I did the evening shift. So I would do the way out all the wets and dries. And the morning shift would come in at 3 o'clock in the morning and they'd see all the wets in one pile and all the dries in the other pile. And they mix them together to make bread. So all the dries had the flour and the salt and the yeast or whatever. And the wets had the eggs and the whatever, just the wets. So that was my job. I had to weigh it all out, measure all out, and have it all ready for them. And then I go home and sleep, and I get up for the morning meditation. I'd sit in meditation. And then like a flash of lightning one morning, out of nowhere, other power operating. The salt. I forgot the salt. And sure enough, one of the batches of bread had no salt that day. And so they labeled it that way, and it sold very well. within us, there's kind of other power, something else. But there has to be kind of a surrender, kind of letting go, kind of relying, Are there other things, other kinds of powers that we can rely on besides something within ourselves? I think that part of the healing of the idea of self-power and other power is something that two traditions have in common. And both traditions tend to, at least in Buddhist traditions, tend to point to overcoming the attachment to self, the clinging to self, or to see the world in terms of me, myself, and mine. So somehow the idea of becoming, in some way, selfless is important in both traditions. And in the other power tradition, you somehow surrender so thoroughly to something else that you kind of are forgetting yourself or letting go of this conceit or the arrogance or this self-concept. And in the self-power approach, it's more like you go into the sense of self and you see it for what it is and penetrate it and seeing for what it is, you let go of it and relax it. But both of them come to the same place, I hope. Another place to heal this divide is in mindfulness practice itself. And mindfulness practice is, remember, one of the dharmas that we can take refuge in and be supported by is practice. And the key practice for Buddhists is mindfulness practice. And one of the most significant things you can do in Buddhist spirituality is to take refuge in mindfulness itself and to trust and rely on mindfulness in all circumstances. Don't do it naively. Don't forget about other things. But there are situations I find myself in where I don't know how to respond, especially interpersonal difficulties or whatever. But I always try to stay mindful. And it's seemingly, every time I stay mindful in situations, that somehow the situation finds its way to resolution. But if I don't practice mindfulness in the middle of it, it doesn't seem to move to resolution in the way that it needs to go. Then I'm just kind of running around frantically, or my mind is at least, what to do, and I can't do this. you know, how to fix it or how to judge it or whatever. But to stay mindful, to take refuge in mindfulness, and moment by moment, just be mindful of what's happening, what's going on. I talked to someone recently who had a very deep meditation practice and had a phenomenal access over the last year or two to some of the deep levels of concentration, the jhanas, the absorptions. And what had happened was that she had started to live in a dualistic world, where a world of a deep meditative absorption as being the place she's supposed to be, and the rest of her life, which was a drag. And she had forgotten about her mindfulness practice. She was, in a sense, trying always to go back to the state of great bliss and peace or whatever. And was kind of struggling with her normal life. But she was a strong practitioner. She'd just forgotten about her mindfulness as being the ultimate refuge. But if you take refuge in mindfulness, moment by moment, the mindfulness will support you, or reality will support you in return. There's a beautiful expression in a Zen poem that goes something like reality, responds to the inquiring impulse. Mindfulness is kind of inquiry, the process of inquiry, of being present for what is. Reality responds to the inquiring impulse. Reality responds to mindfulness. The practice of honesty, of being clearly acknowledging honestly what's happening in the present moment, it's as if reality then responds. Why is that? I mean, I can't explain it exactly. But certainly it's true, I think, on an inner level, on a psychic level. So as people practice mindfulness, it's important to think that there's two aspects. There is an aspect of putting ourselves on the escalator, putting ourselves in the stream, and then relaxing and letting the stream carry us. So this part of the spirit of mindfulness is both making the effort to be mindful and showing up moment by moment. But once we show up and are mindful, is to get out of the way and let something else happen. So trust becomes a very important part of mindfulness practice. You have to show up and be very carefully mindful of what's happening now. But you don't have to be concerned about what happens next, or how it happens next. You don't have to be concerned about manipulating or changing or judging, or that it's, you know, you don't have to concern. If it gets worse, don't be worried about it. Things get worse, so-called worse. Don't worry about that. If things get better, don't worry about that. Just be mindful of how things are. Trust the mindfulness practice. And then what needs to happen will happen. So it's just pointing towards the simplicity of mindfulness practice. Simplicity is you don't have to do anything else when you're sitting in meditation, if you're sitting well and stable, if you're present, if you manage to arrive and be here and have the mind settled in the present moment, then to stay mindful of what's happening now. And then surrender to what's happening now, or relax about what's happening now. It's none of your business what's happening now. All you're supposed to do is to notice it. So there's kind of relaxing, surrendering. So there's both going on. And probably when you get down to the very moment of practice, moment by moment, both are, it's almost as if both are happening at the same time. You're showing up and you're relaxing. Showing up and relaxing maybe are the same thing. Showing up and surrendering are the same. And that's where I think the healing, or this, if you need to heal, this divide between self-power and other power disappears. That mindfulness practice itself, the distinction between self-power and other power disappears when you're coursing in mindfulness, when you're deeply engaged in mindfulness practice, when you're settled on in your practice. So as you go about your practice, there are times when maybe you're not going to be right there on that razor's edge of no self-power, no other power, just mindfulness. But you're going to be one side or the other on the divide. And you might think about what is most needed for you. There are times what's most needed is to relax and kind of rely on some other power, some other, rely on the Dharma, take refuge in the Dharma. And other times what's needed is to engage more yourself, step on the escalator, rely on yourself, self-power. It's up to you to pay attention, to live an ethical life, to practice a life of goodness, to cultivate your goodness, to do these things. And so at different times, different things are needed. If you're complacent, then maybe you need to do self-power thing. If you've been striving too much, maybe you need other power kind of approach. So you have to kind of explore that a little bit. Both are needed. So that's my thoughts for today. And I hope that's helpful. And does anyone have any comments or questions you'd like to make? We have a couple of minutes still. Yes?
Well, I think part of the self versus other concept with the Pure Land background or Buddhist is that if you surrender to a certain extent, those powers then sort of reach out to you and help you along, and you're still actively engaged, but that the powers will sort of align with you. And I kind of get the impression that's where Martin Luther King was coming from, too, is that he believed in a higher power, but he very much believed that people had to be actively moving in the right direction in order for that power to get activated or to help people.
Beautiful. Yes, it's very much what I'm saying here. So there's both act together, work together. It's not either or, but it's both and. Both are needed. There's some involvement of us, and then in response to our involvement, something else happens in response. Yes, please.
Just a quick question. Yeah. Are you using Pure Land and Mahayana interchangeably?
No. Pure Land Buddhism is a subsect of Mahayana Buddhism. Well, it depends how you see it. In Japan, Pure Land Buddhism is a particular sect of Mahayana. Outside of Japan, in China and Tibet, Pure Land Buddhism is integrated into the Mahayana tradition. They're not divided separately. And some Mahayana Buddhists in Tibet, for example, are really into it, and some are, don't pay much attention to it.
I'm sorry.
Some Tibetan Buddhists are really into the Pure Land idea, and some Tibetan Buddhists, that's not very relevant teaching for them. Okay, so may the power be with you.